Hello and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
This is the show where we talk about the political economy of speculative fiction. That is, how decisions are made, how wealth is distributed, and how shipbuilding contracts are awarded to Martian shipbuilding consortiums.
Today, we are discussing the economic and human, or as Marshall likes to call it, economic costs of the Doniger and Doniger-class ships in S.A. Corey's The Expanse.
So, for those of you who don't know what the Doniger is, it's a really big spaceship that the civilization of Mars builds in the Expanse universe. And spoilers ahead. That's right, if you've turned it off now, good. It gets blowed up. It gets blowed up real good. A secret faction has built these really fast, quick stealth ships with really intelligent torpedoes, and those innovations in armament have kind of rendered the Doniger meaningless, despite being, you know, the top-of-the-line premier warship until that very moment.
Now, we are making a lot of assumptions in this episode, and they may or may not be accurate. You know, it's very tough to talk about the future in certain terms. But it's a good jumping-off point for discussion, if nothing else. So please do not start saving up for your own Doniger based on these cost assumptions. I think you'll find everything, if you were to try to build it now, you would find it much, much, much more expensive. So don't think because you have, I'm not going to say the number, it's a surprise.
So, Steven, how much? How much? Big number right off the top.
Here's my guess is like, I mean, isn't it just basically an aircraft carrier in space? So, like, what does an aircraft carrier cost? 13, yeah, okay. Yeah, so like I'd say, like, what, like a dozen, maybe roughly a dozen billion, right?
So you're guessing that that the Doniger costs about the same as an aircraft carrier, about 13-ish billion?
Yeah, I mean, I'd assume. I don't know. I'm not a professional spaceship cost estimator, but now that I say it out loud, I think that might be wrong, because there's a lot of things spaceships do that aircraft carriers don't do, like be vacuum proof
multiple times over, which we will get to. Yeah, so when we cost it out, we got a roughly 100 billion, roughly 100 billion for one Doniger, and that will include, you know, like just your dry costs of like the steel or whatever material they use to build it. Maybe there's like ceramics that are on the ship. I don't know. And all of its like arsenal. It's the various weapons that are attached to it. Cause it's got, remember it has like just about 60 point defense cannons. So just like defensive weapons on it. It has 60 big guns, which is way more than any aircraft carrier has.
Yeah.
It has 14 torpedo tubes to shoot torpedoes, you know, forward and backward. It's got two big rail guns on it, probably one facing front and back. It's got 2,000 people living on it full time. and this thing is massive. The Doniger is like 130 meters.
It's 500 meters long.
500 meters, sorry. Yeah, 500.
It's
500 meters long.
Yeah. And 60 meters wide at its widest point.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think like 30 meters wide at its most narrow point.
So this is like
front end there.
This is bigger. What did we say? Bigger than most of our skyscrapers?
Yeah, bigger than most buildings. Yeah.
Like yeah. This thing is just mind-bogglingly big. Enormous. And so it has a cost to go along with that.
It has a price tag. It's much more expensive than make a skyscraper and then make it move through space and not require any external input of air, water, or anything for prolonged periods.
And now make it be able to shoot down other
other
skyscrapers in space.
Yeah.
No
maybe
problem.
It's easier. Maybe it's easier said than done. So how can we break this down? How do we get here?
We assumed just a per ton of a submarine. How much it costs to build per ton of like material, essentially, and said, let's just we made heavy use of the Expanse wiki.
Yeah.
to do this. So the folks that maintain the Expanse wiki, well done.
Yeah, thank you.
You were a wealth of information, and you made this project even fathomable. Could not have done it without you. So we looked at how much the Donager weighs, like it just its dry weight. So so this ship is like 250 million kilos, roughly, somewhere in there. And so we assume building and that makes up the majority of the cost, just the materials going into this behemoth of a ship. And that's about $90 billion.
Yeah, and then so what we did is we kind of took a by weight cost of a submarine, which we kind of found was probably the thing we build a lot of that are roughly similar to spaceships, in the sense that we don't build a lot of spaceships. So we thought it would get way more expensive if we compared it to a spaceship, but we wanted to be fair, so we said submarine. And yeah, that works. So, because like a United States Navy Virginia class submarine costs about $354 per kilogram. If you're buying them bulk, that's what it would cost you. And that covers its propulsion system, its life support systems, its basic computer and sensor systems, communication systems, and torpedo and missile launching capacity, which are all kind of things the Donager has in relatively equal proportions.
Yeah, I mean, roughly. Like, this, again, this is a really rough estimate. It's probably more expensive because I think the Donager has multiple separate computer systems. Right? Like, yeah. It's got one that... It has an AI that just does point defense cannons. And that's it. And it's probably got an AI that just does life support of, like... Do we have the right amount of air in here? And is it in the right mixtures for humans to breathe? Because we're not getting it from anywhere else. We can't just, like, surface and resupply our air.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a lot of things that there's a lot of things that you would need to even add to a submarine. So if anything, this is probably low-balled.
Yeah, I think, like, we're being generous here. But you know, they've built a lot of these spaceships. So they probably, there's some economies of scale and there's some learnings and there's some technology. So we're being generous, but you know, that makes up 90% of the cost of a ship is just like the material that goes into it. And then we estimated there's some real wild estimates going on here for your point defense cannons. We looked at the Phalanx close in weapon systems.
Which, again, are not a perfect analogy.
No, but I mean, they're close. They have a generally same idea, right? Of like...
Yeah.
They're supposed to shoot
down... Machine gun on a robot arm.
Yeah.
With a sensor.
Yeah.
Which is ostensibly what a PDC is, only bigger.
Yeah.
And in space.
And so one of these Phalanx cannons, machine guns,
turrets,
whatever we call them, one of these Phalanx, they fire off 3,000 rounds per minute. We used that as a roughly correct assumption for the PDC, 3,000 rounds per minute. And we assumed that the Donager would want to be able to have 60 full minutes of PDC capacity, that they could be in either 1-hour-long battle or several smaller battles adding up to about an hour.
Which is probably, again, low.
probably low, but who knows? I don't know. I mean, maybe it's easier to resupply these things with rounds. One Phalanx round is $30, because it is 2 pounds of tungsten.
Yeah.
So we assumed $30, 3,000 rounds per minute, 60 minutes, and there are 58 of these things going. So that's only $300 million for point defense.
For bullets.
Just for your bullets. Just for your just to shoot them. That's it.
Yeah. and this is on top of the cost of the phalanx turrets themselves.
Yes.
Right. Which
we're another costs. $300 million.
Which, because they're about $5.5 million each. Yeah. So you know, and so this is really, really a very expensive proposition.
Yeah.
Because weapons are a tremendously expensive thing.
They in are our so world. Expensive.
And as they certainly will be in the future.
Torpedoes?
Yeah, so I kind of base these on intercontinental ballistic missiles, because they're those, you know, they go very far, go very fast, they're staged, they're very complex, and they cost about $70 million each, and, you know, so, and I assume that these, and we kind of assume then that they carry at least 200, because they have, what, how many tubes?
14 tubes.
They have 14 tubes.
So 8 fore, 6 aft.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah. I mean, the Rocinante has 2 tubes and carries 20. So we kind of assumed, again, like 10 each, and then plus like an additional bit of spillover. And then we round it up, basically. Here.
Yeah, like a rounding up. They probably have a little bit of spare. Maybe because, you know, the Doniger can also carry two of these. I think 2. Yeah. Rocinante.
It can carry ships. Up to 4 ships. Two, and typically that loadout is two missile corvettes and 2 skiffs for Marines.
Oh, okay.
That's the typical loadout, but it can carry up to 4 of those ships, and they can be, yeah. So then those are typically their skiffs or.
Yeah. So if they have these corvettes, maybe the corvette goes out, does some shooting, lands back again, and they have some spare torpedoes that they can top up the Corvette again, something like that. Because, like, the Corvette's not going to have a lot of spare storage space.
Spare missile capacity.
Yeah. You know, the Doniger kind of plays that role as well of, like, you come home, you get topped up, you go back out again.
Yeah. So, again, so we thought that was a so we thought 200 torpedoes was a conservative estimate.
Yeah. Yeah. And what does that run us?
That runs you $14 billion.
Yeah. No problem.
Yeah, and they're firing dozens of torpedoes in a battle, right? Like,
well, yeah, because like one salvo is 14.
Yeah,
torpedoes.
Yeah, that's just I'm getting out of bed in the morning. So, $5 billion, which again, like these are things that these technologically advanced armies fighting a quote unquote like symmetrical war would. Theoretically do on a normal basis.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They would be letting loose. And, you know, I mean, cruise missiles cost about $1 million each. I believe it was like, what, 2017? Trump launched a salvo of 54 cruise missiles at Syria. So that's just in an afternoon. He was just like, yeah, I'll just call up. I'm just going to casually order up $54 million to piss off Bashar al-Assad. You know, think about if the U.S. had spent, and that's only like the unit cost. It doesn't include that the fact they had to fuel up planes and fly them and launch them and target them and all those things. So wild to think about what war costs, particularly technologically advanced war.
And then this last one is we're looking at the personnel cost.
Yeah. So this one got. This was very difficult. It's very difficult to say what a human life costs. So,
because we're saying when you lost the Doniger, that's the cost, is like the human life lost on the Doniger. So not necessarily like how much they were being paid annually to be on the Doniger. That, I mean, that would be a different thing entirely.
Well, because and a whole lot lower. Theoretically, then they got a savings. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Because now they don't have that personnel cost anymore. Which is, oh boy.
Well, I mean, maybe. I guess it depends on, like,
It depends on a lot of things.
It does.
But we kind of looked at, it's very difficult to estimate that loss. And so we kind of wanted to think not just of the immediate cost to the Martian Navy. Because to be honest, kind of what we looked at was like that, you know, training costs. I asked someone in the Navy and they told me training costs for a sailor was about $25,000. Which again seems low, but I don't know. Like it's like a, you know, like
take. Well, I mean, that's a one-time thing.
Yeah. So sure, like $25,000, and then plus, you know, in the U.S. Armed Forces, if you die, your next of kin get $10,000. One-time $10,000 payment.
Yep.
And it's called a death gratuity, which is a bad name. I just think that's just not a great name. Here's your death tip.
I think in Canada, it's also called some sort of gratuity like that.
I'm sure it is. That's the name for it.
It's like twice what you earn in a year.
Mm.
So
yeah, but anyway, so they have a $10,000 death gratuity. So strictly speaking, the cost to the Martian Navy per person is only $35,000, which is not enormous, I guess.
I mean, there are 2,000 of them, so it does start to add up.
Yeah. So we wanted to round that number out. We kind of then added like the average cost of raising a child for a median income household typically is from, you know, zero from birth to 18 in the U.S. According to 2019 estimates on Wikipedia was $234,900. So, you know, so that's for a family with a median income of $54,000, which is maybe a little high. I don't know. Again, very difficult to price these. So we said, you know, that this they also cost Martian society that much, right? Because that's kind of now money. I think militaries tend to skew younger.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to skew towards younger people. So you're losing then also. I think you're generally disproportionately losing a lot of future potential when you lose those people, right? Then we also calculated the cost of a public K-12 education. We used the Alberta metrics, and then we converted it to U.S. dollars. We did some simplifying of the cost of that, and we said that costs about $62,852 to educate a child in a public education setting. And then we still didn't think that was enough. So then we just added kind of $1 million, which is... That's kind of that dollar value that represents that lost lifetime earning, that lost economic contribution, the cost to the families, you know, like what is the psychological damage to their children, to their partners, what's this going to do? How's this going to trigger, you know, debts they have? You know, what's the total net loss to the economy going to be? And we only did $1 million because in Canada, that's kind of the base economic liability you have if you kill someone in a traffic accident. So that's generally thought to be around $1 million. So, yeah, I think that's kind of where we came to that. So that kind of came to then $1,321,852 per person. Multiply that by 2,086 people. That gives you $2.757 billion in personnel cost to the Martian economy, whatever that means.
Yeah. And that's probably also like a conservative estimate of like, is that?
Well, I mean, what if an Elon Musk was on board? Or what if an Einstein was on, like what if a Google a Sergey Brin was on board? Then you've theoretically hosed yourself of billions of dollars into your economy.
Exactly.
I don't actually believe that, but very very expensive, but. These numbers don't mean a lot, because like anything, cost is highly intertwined with budget, right? So it doesn't mean a heck of a lot to say I spent X amount of dollars, because it really is dependent on how you value a dollar, right? So if you know, for me, $100 expense for a dinner would be extravagant, but for other people, $100 expense for a dinner is negligible. Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how much money Mars has. And let's think, what is the loss of the Dowager to Mars relative to its overall wealth?
Yeah. So again, some of the assumptions that we're making here, apparently Mars has a Martian dollar.
A Martian credit.
Something like that. A Martian dollar or a Martian credit. It's the MCR dollar.
Sorry. Oh, Martian Congressional Republic dollar.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, whatever. Call it whatever. It doesn't really matter.
Call it a pound.
Yeah.
Call it a lira.
It's fine. And the fine folks at the Expanse Wiki estimate the GDP per capita to be 111 Martian dollars.
That's not helpful.
Like, oh, okay, great. So
thank you, Mark. Thank you. I mean, we genuinely thank you, but it's not actually helpful because we don't know what that means.
Yeah,
we have no way to convert it to U.S. dollars.
Right, exactly. So we don't know the purchasing power of Martian dollars, and you know, we don't even know the purchasing power of Earth dollars in the future. Right, this is like 350 years in the future or something like that. 330 years in the future. Inflation over a period of time like that is basically meaningless because you don't know what has happened, right? They probably are using like a UN dollar now. They may have adopted the American dollar, but then like debased it to say, actually, you know, it's worth less. Whatever. It's useless to talk about.
They may have developed multiple currency systems.
Yeah, like exactly.
They have basic, and then they have currency. And those things are different somehow, but they have relative exchange value in the economy.
Yeah.
I mean, and not that you can't do that. Not that I think those things are bad. Lots of countries have multiple currencies. Oh, yeah.
And the idea of saying, okay, look, there's basic, and it gets you a living. You don't have to worry about dollars anymore. You just get your basic needs met. That's fine. That's, you know, it's actually quite generous in comparison to the modern life. But it does mean, though, that it's sort of like talking in future UN dollar or Martian dollar is just not, it's not a helpful discussion. So I just went ahead and assumed, and I don't think this is ridiculous, I was just like, let's just put everything into nominal 2020 US dollars. We'll just call that good. We'll just say we're estimating their GDP in our currency. And that way we can kind of have an idea. Because that's what the cost of the ship is in. It's in, you know, essentially 2020 US dollars. So their economy should also be measured in 2020 U.S. dollars.
And I think when you're dealing with writers, a lot of the time that's what they tend to do anyway. So, and you can't blame them. Like, that's actually a really smart thing to do. That's way smarter than inventing your own
Much easier to currency. Keep track of it that way.
Yeah, and like trying to come up with prices for stuff.
Yeah. So
good on you, S.A. Corey.
The
group of people. I don't know how many of them there are. How many are they? It's not
two
one,
of them.
It's a pen name.
Yeah, there's two people.
Okay. Good job to both of you.
So the world GDP was estimated at about $83 trillion. And the population last year was in March, was estimated at 7.8 million people, giving us a rough GDP per capita of just...
Sorry, did you say 7.8 million people?
Sorry, I did. I did say 7.8 million. Yeah, we've lost 90%.
Oh gosh.
More than like 99% of the population was lost last year. I'm so sorry.
Holy shit.
To everyone. 7.8 billion with a B billion people in the world last year around March, giving us a rough GDP per capita of a little under 11,000 per person. Populations of Mars and Earth, they give me some trouble because I don't like what I see. Anyway, that's not, no way. No heckin' way. The Expanse Wiki says Mars has a population of 9 billion. So it's large, like it has a bigger population than all of Earth currently. And they live underground or in bubbles. And that just strikes me as unlikely. It's also a lot of people. Earth took quite a while to get to 9 billion people. It didn't just happen overnight. It happened over a pretty good course of time. I get that there's a couple hundred years here, but that's a couple hundred years to recreate the entire population of the Earth, which is wild.
On Mars.
On another planet where it's actively hostile to you. Giving birth is dangerous there. I was like, maybe that's probably not maybe the best estimate. But I was looking around and I saw another number that said 4 billion. And I was like, okay, well, that's still pretty high, but maybe more believable. I don't know. So I'm saying that their population is somewhere between 4 and 9 billion people, assuming the GDP per capita that we have now, taking that constant for Mars, they are as productive as current Earth dwellers. That gives us a GDP on Mars somewhere between 43 trillion and 97 trillion. And then Earth being, you know, roughly three times the size. This is another thing, is like Earth's population apparently balloons to 31 billion people, which I just have a hard time believing. Logistical systems on Earth would have to be amazing to support that kind of life, right? So many technological changes that it would have to undergo, right?
Presumably then also technological distribution has improved, like people's access to birth control has improved,
well, this is the thing, right?
People aren't eking out a living in like rural peasant farming, hopefully. Well, theoretically.
I hope not. And it's not a matter of fitting us, because we can all fit. I think like right now, if you took all of the people on the planet and you put us on Madagascar, we'd fill the island of Madagascar, and the rest of the planet would be devoid of humans. Is a thing that I heard, and I was like, probably believable, because we're not that big. Because when you look at the expanse, like when you look at the show and you hear about it in the books, there's still a lot of wide open space on the planet. And that makes a lot of sense, because we're not that big. So even 31 billion of us, we don't become like a oozing organic mass that just covers all of the land of the planet. That's not a thing. But, if you look at population estimates going forward, right now, people think by 2100, we might reach 10 billion, which is, you know, another third, like 33% more than what we've got now, roughly. So that's a pretty big increase. That's over like another 80 years. In the last 80 years, our population like doubled. And it's not going to do that again, right? We're not going to go from 5 billion, close to 8 billion we have now, to 16 billion. They're like, no, probably things are going to slow down based on the trends. Population growth is going to slow down and maybe even decline. So, like, we might hit 10 billion and then start falling backward, because it starts to get scarce and costs start to get higher. And it's just like, do we really want to be keeping this number of people?
Well, I can tell you that for the majority of women in the world, I think there's a good chance that a large number of them do not want to have 6 children.
Well, that's the thing, right?
I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that. I feel pretty confident saying that if you're a woman who's very happy to have, you know, 7 or 8 children, good on you. No problem. But
I think
I don't think you're the majority.
Want to have 12 is the ideal number.
And I realize, yes, we're a podcast of two men talking about what women are or do not want, and it's a big mistake. So I'm going to shut up about it.
Well, I mean, just based on trends, I think we can say that that's probably true. In places where women have more education and have more autonomy, they also have fewer children. There's a correlation there, and it's a pretty strong correlation across the entire world.
We're not
going
to say what it means. But it's there.
Could be all for all sorts of reasons. But if we assume then that, you know, people start slowing down and the Earth's growth rate is barely above the replacement rate, I don't know that we're ever going to get to 31 billion people on the planet. right? Like, the technological improvements are going to have to be amazing to triple the population that we have right now. Quadruple the population that we have right now. That's just, like, that's a wild idea to think that we can get there. So I have some concerns with the idea of Earth population maybe getting to 31 billion. So I said, like, maybe we stick around the 10 billion mark. And as a high estimate, I left it at the books of 31 billion.
I do want to add that the belt is comparative to this, a rounding error.
Yeah, it's like 70 million people, maybe 100 million people.
Yeah, there are so few, and this makes sense. Obviously, the carrying capacity of space is lower.
Well, let's be careful with using carrying capacity of anything.
Well, fair enough. That's a bad concept. I agree. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that's a shitty way to think about things.
We're not Malthusians.
No, we're not. That's a bullshit premise. Should be rejected. Compared to these populations on the planet, the population on the belt is
minuscule, which is kind of how you see that a little bit in how they treat the belt, where it's just sort of like, why do we even think about you? Like, you're just the people who work out in space. It doesn't matter. Like, you're whatever. Go away. We'll just replace you with other people who want to work in space. There's a lot of people.
Yeah, there's so many of us, and we need so much, and there's so few of you.
But that leaves Earth GDP somewhere between about 108 trillion to 335 trillion. So, you know, around roughly three times that of Mars, because it's just a bigger population, more stuff going on. So maybe that counts Luna as well. I don't know. For Mars, though, that means that building a single Doniger costs between about 0.25% to, if your GDP is higher, 0.1% of your GDP. And it's mind-boggling that a single piece of infrastructure can be measured at that level, right? Because this is the GDP of the entire planet of Mars, and 0.25% of it goes to one ship. And then they built 12 of them.
Yeah.
And so, like, the United States.
So that's 4%. Right, that's now, 4%.
Yeah.
So for contrast, 3%. Then, government budgets. How much is a whole government's budget of a GDP typically?
Well, that's a it depends a lot on the anyway.
I'll save you. I actually looked this up.
It's like 30%. Like, in the case of,
So most governments have about a 30% GDP. Budget for the entire government, and that includes everything. That includes defense, that includes social services, infrastructure, all of it. Right?
And maybe some countries go higher. I think the 30% is the Americans, and they probably have a bit of a lower government spending
than
some other countries. Partially
because of their ideology.
Yeah.
And also the fact that their GDP is very, very large.
That too.
Partially because of their ideology. It's like the snake is biting its tail there a little bit. But yeah.
The budget Ouroboros.
I mean, Mars, they're crazy right-wing nut jobs there. So let's say they have 30%. So then it's, you know, so 12 Donagers, 0.25%. So that's 4%. 4 of 30. So
well, and so let's say, because the U.S. right now, they're building the Gerald Ford supercarriers as their big, like, anchor ships. And they're planning on building, I think, 11 or 12 of them. But they're planning on building them over the course of 60 years. Like, they only build one of these things once every 5 years. It's like, it's a big deal.
Yeah, BFDs.
And they are super expensive. They're also measurable on an overall federal government budget line. You could put
cost about $12 billion.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, it shows up on, like, if you wanted to cost it out, it'd be like, okay, well, There's the budget of all of the various departments. There's the aircraft carrier, and below the aircraft carrier, you have the Environmental Protection Agency. So,
yeah,
like, just as a mind-bogglingly, an entire government department costs less. So Mars, though, I think Mars is probably building them faster. They're, like, pumping these things out because they're in an arms race, and they're trying to defend against Earth. Even just from an economic perspective, they have to be like, they've got to punch above their weight, because Earth could easily outspend them, right? Like, build two aircraft carriers for every one of Mars. So Mars is like, we really got to go hard on these. So I think rather than every 5 years, they're going like annually. They get a Doniger every year.
Right. When wrapped up under the tree.
That's right.
The big bow on it.
And that's like 1% of their entire budget then. Mm-hmm. 1% of entire government spending.
On one vehicle.
on one ship. Well, and I guess part of that is like, yeah, you lose that ship. But even without the loss of life, just on the building of it, it is one vehicle. So that's wild. It's big, which then makes me wonder how their society is laid out, right? Because we think of them as being like, well, they're very warlike, and they're very martial, and they're probably more right wing and more libertarian and more freedom loving. But based on the fact that they just like sort of conscript these people into a grand project of terraforming Mars and having a navy that is comparable to a planet twice their size, three times their size, potentially. I don't know. They're either fascist and the government is like a dictatorship of Congress that just like tells everyone how to spend and what they spend and where they live and how they live, or they're really, really socialist. And they have like 5-year plans and they know
wage and price controls.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things about Mars they talk about, and this is where I think like, cause one of the things they talk about is like the difference between basic, like Earth having basic and Mars doesn't need basic because Mars has what seems to be a jobs guarantee.
Well, and if not a jobs guarantee, sense.
Something close to it. Right. Anyone who wants to work can find work on Mars. And in the show, I think in the books as well, it's a really big deal when people can't find work.
Yes.
You have a population of unemployment, like an unemployed population. And I think
the only people on Mars who are, you know, expected to be unemployed are people who are, you know, either not old enough to have a job yet or are too old to have a job. And they're like, yeah, I did my time. I'm retired.
Or have some kind of disability or whatever.
On Mars?
And if they're doing something else with those people other than taking care of them, then they're definitely in the fascist camp.
Yes, exactly.
Because that's one of those definitional criteria. You have your eugenics program is...
Oh, okay. I think, like, government spending and central planning is core to the Martian identity.
Yes.
I don't think that it's like a private corporation is like, well, I'm going to stake out the...
I'm going to get the contract for making Mars's atmosphere.
Yeah.
And you're going to pay me.
I think the government just does it.
They didn't tender an atmosphere bid. Yeah.
And I think like they probably own their own shipyards and
they do.
You know, so when we talk about like Martian shipbuilding consortiums, it's Mars. Mars is the shipbuilding consortium. That's its role.
There's not Lockheed Martin Mars.
Yeah.
Right.
Irving Mars.
Irving. Well, this is where we have an interesting parallel because did you hear this drop this week? Canada's ships, surface ships, are delayed.
No.
So Canada ordered a couple, like I think several new surface ships from a defense consortium to be built, and they're now going to be delayed an additional 10 years. And the reason this is happening is exactly because there's intellectual property issues, there's procurement issues, there's, you know, things over cost overages and then political consequences for those overages and so on down the line. And that's really, you know, you get this thing where if you have a national shipbuilder, you know, you just do it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to secure property rights. I mean, and this comes on the heels of a major crisis with our diesel submarines where we couldn't get the intellectual property rights to produce components that were not produced.
Are you turning this to a complaint about the Avro Arrow?
And it all goes back to I think like it's kind of the same thing over and over again, right? And how like you get people make it people make a lot of money off of defense contracting. But from a perspective of maybe necessarily like countries that have national defense institutions that produce their weapons tend to do it pretty well and don't tend to have the kind of social and political problems that you get from having an arms industry. Wherein the arms industry, if you have a national defense, you know, institution, you say produce arms, stop producing arms. And they're indifferent because they're the government, right? And then, you know, when they're not producing arms, they're going to produce something else, right? But if you have a companies, the companies never want to stop making arms. They are never ready for peace.
Yeah, absolutely. Which makes a lot of sense because that's how they get their profit.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of benefit to having a nationalized defense production.
You get the defense production that you want when you want it.
Yeah, rather than creating a dependent, greedy child.
That costs you $250,000 to raise?
$250 billion to raise. And what it drinks is blood. Human blood.
Human blood. The loss of this for Mars, it's a crushing blow. Right. Well, a Doniger is not easy to replace. It's like it's a culmination of an entire year's worth of work just to build one of them. And then you lose 2,000 highly trained crew that are running it, and you lose all of the stuff that goes with it, and you lose all of the future life there. But it's also like a moral blow of like, this is the most technologically advanced death dealer in the galaxy. And it just got blown up.
It's a David and Goliath situation, right? You had your biggest, strongest, toughest guy, and some shrimpy kid killed it.
Like before the show, Steven and I were talking, and it was like, by the time they finish building the Doniger class, it's just about time to start with a new class of ship, even though it's probably only been, you know, 12 or 15 years. And that's a pretty short lifespan for like a class of ship. The Donagers aren't going to just stop being used, but they might stop being like flagships because all of a sudden the stealth tech that was available that defeated the Doniger needs to be countered or incorporated or something. And you end up with a new class of ship.
And this is where the Expanse mirrors a very real problem that we have in our current naval warfare world, right? Which is this issue that naval ships are running a arms race against missiles and torpedoes. And as in the Expanse, when missiles got a little better, they started blowing up their big fancy ships. So too are surface ships today in navies in jeopardy of being completely overnight, just like it happened to Doniger, being completely surprised, overwhelmed, mm-hmm. and irrelevant to the battle space. And there's a very real risk of this. Now I'm going to talk about the 2002 Millennium exercise conducted by the Pentagon, which was a simulated war with Iran.
This charming anecdote comes by way of the Radio War Nerd podcast, who did a really, really good story walking through the Millennium exercise and everything that happened, and some quite interesting stories about the personalities involved. So I really encourage people to check out the Millennium Exercise episode by Radio Warner. I know you got to subscribe, I think it's worth subscribing.
Okay, they said, so they had a red team and a blue team. Blue team was USA, red team was Iran, and they had a big, very expensive simulated war between a U.S. naval carrier group in the Persian Gulf. And what happened was, at the beginning of the war, Iran completely overwhelmed the carrier group in the Gulf with missiles. Oof. And sank the carrier group in the opening days of the simulated war. And the consequence of this was that the U.S. completely lost its capacity to prosecute any further conflict with Iran. And the cost in dollars and human life was utterly catastrophic. And it was so severe and so embarrassing that the marshals of the exercises ordered that the simulation be altered so that the U.S. could refloat its boats. And that the red team force doctrine could not turn off their radars on their launchers after launching. So that way the U.S. electronic warfare missiles could find the launchers and destroy them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So these large surface ships that they're continuing to build are an absolute emperor's no clothes situation. Where every year these missiles get faster, their range gets further, the AIs and computers on board them get better, and they get smarter and sneakier. And these large surface ships that just get bigger and bigger and have larger and larger electromagnetic profiles get more and more vulnerable. And it's a significant problem. To the point where there were, like, a symmetrical conflict. Where, you know, the U.S. wasn't fighting Yemen or, you know, Afghanistan or a severely crippled Iraq. They could suffer incalculably massive losses. And they wouldn't know it until the war had already started. And I think the thing is, if that happens in real life, it would go nuclear. If the U.S. once said, all right, let's play a war, and their enemies said, all right, fine, I sank all your battleships. The U.S. would not say, the U.S. would not take its 10,000 dead boys and go home to sulk. That would give them the social license to drop the fucking nuke.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's very scary.
Just reading about the Millennium Challenge when you mention it, it's wild because it's like it was two American teams.
Yeah.
One playing as a fictitious Middle Eastern country.
Yeah, that was Iran.
It was Iran. It was Iran. But it wasn't an actual Iranian general or anybody doing this. This was an American general or admiral or whatever.
He was a Marine general.
Playing against the Americans. And the wild thing is that it was sort of like they said, okay, fine, you win. We're gonna stop and we're gonna put all of Blue's forces back on the board and we're gonna reset everything. And now you have to play by these new rules that let us win.
Yeah.
You can't do your thing. They didn't even learn from it and like do something different. They were like, change the rules, here's the script. Which is the wild part of this, right? Is that it's like the flaw is pointed out to them. And they're just like, eh.
I think and they yet they continue to ink deals on new aircraft carriers. Despite knowing this.
Yeah. Which is just like wild.
Oh, this is getting way too into the weeds. I apologize. We're gonna stop nerding out about U.S. naval force doctrine. But I think the point is well observed.
It's a good illustration, though, to say when you invent something really big and expensive and dangerous, the people who are opposing you will invent something small and fast and dangerous, specifically designed to neutralize your big, expensive, dangerous thing. So in the last season of The Expanse, the show, or in the game, in the book, which book is it? Nemesis Games?
Nemesis Games, yeah.
Well, the Belters do a couple of things. One is like throwing rocks down the gravity well. They put stealth technology on asteroids and then throw them at Earth. And that's just like wild because no one was expecting it. So it's super effective. But then they also used, and I don't know exactly what, if it was like a railgun shotgun or if it was a meteor cloud that they redirected or something. But they just fired a whole lot of small ballistics at ships at high speed and just tore them apart. Because they're not used to fighting that way anymore.
Because they're trying to target torpedoes.
Right. Yeah, they're expecting like big, larger explosive things. And instead they get very small ballistics that they weren't thinking. Because bullets...
Which are cheaper.
Way cheaper. But bullets sort of like have a downside on Earth that you can only shoot them so far. And then they fall out of the sky. Rockets, you can kind of keep them going all the way around and hit anywhere you want. And if you don't rethink that, that's kind of what the railgun was. It was like one big bullet, right? You could take a thing out with it. And they thought, well, maybe instead of a railgun, like one big railgun chunk, we'll do like hundreds of small railgun chunks. And that, yeah, super cheap, super inexpensive, but super effective because no one can see it coming. Or by the time they see it coming, they can't move.
And this is exactly the position that we, the Empire, as the NATO powers are going to face eventually.
Yeah.
Right. We're gonna bump into this cheap technology, and we've enjoyed this period where we feel like we can just go around with our very, very technologically advanced army and just stomp whoever we want and not think about it coming back at us.
A war with no losses on our side.
Yeah, decaffeinated warfare. Yeah, we get to, yeah, but everyone can just do it from drone screens. Drone pilots can work from home, kiss their daughters, close the spare bedroom door, and then kill a family in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, but that can't go on.
No, there will be repercussions for it. So, I mean, ideally, for me, we end that before we get to the point that they find a way to kill us. Global equality. You know, a universal basic income for everyone. And get people on our side before it's too late.
And again, when you think about the fact that if the Belters are a rounding error in the population of the system.
Yeah.
Isn't it significantly cheaper to help them, support them, give them provision and some autonomy than it is to spend a quarter of a percent of your GDP on just one tool you try to use to scare them that doesn't even work? So yeah, so this is part of, I think, what makes The Expanse really good and really clever and really dynamic and interesting in the way that it talks about and analogizes the problems we have in our present world. And that's what we are all about on this show, I
think. That's what we do. That's our bread and butter.
And if you want more of that, you should definitely follow our show. You can find all of our episodes on androidsandassets.ca, or you know, just type Androids and Assets into your podcatcher. Not Androids and Aliens. We're Androids and Assets. But that's okay. Come find us. Listen to all our episodes. They're pretty good, I think. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Twitter at AssetDroid and Instagram at AssetDroid.
So the next time that you are in a room inking a multi-billion or trillion-dollar deal or aircraft carriers or dreadnought-class ships in space, turn us on. Think about how much that's going to actually cost you. And is it worth it?
Maybe amend your RFP to consider what small, fast weapons might be used to kill your big, shiny toy.
Or redirect that to aid funding and obviate the need for war in the first place.